supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Forecast, periods of light snow and rain throughout the day, the high 39. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show for you today, folks. We're going to talk about the pruning of fruit trees, which I apparently don't do enough of, and we're going to talk about the secret that most fruit growers don't like to talk about, but that gets you big, beautiful fruits at the end of the season. It's a heartbreaking thing to do, however. We're also going to talk about mapping the spread of running bamboo as it invades the entire nation. Well, that's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Karen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. What a pleasure to talk to you today. I called with something that I hope you can help me out with here.
I have a question for you first.
Sure.
Where are you?
I'm calling from beautiful Florence, New Jersey, right along the Delaware.
Oh, okay. Very good. What can we do for you?
My question is, about 3 years ago, we started noticing these invasive creatures into our home, and my husband and I used to call them jumpers. They looked like a spider, and just when you got close enough to give it a good squish, those little suckers would just jump at you. So it's kind of like half spider, half cricket.
Well,
and I wanted to know if you could tell me anything about them.
Are they really interestingly colored, almost like camouflaged?
Kind of.
Yes.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
Camel crickets, cave crickets, they have a number of common names. They are uncommonly large, and they do freak people out.
That is putting it mildly. My husband, who usually takes care of the pests in the house, it has been known to totally freak him out.
Ah! But they're only in, like, your basement or your garage or somewhere like that, right?
Exactly. That we found them in our basement, but what happens is they start making their way up the stairs, and then they're invading our primary area.
Crickets are kind of ubiquitous. They're all over the place. They come in all shapes and sizes. And I do notice these creatures in my basement and in, like, outdoor crawl spaces during times of extreme dampness. They are creatures of dampness. Now, is your basement a little damp?
I would say so.
If you were to run a dehumidifier in the basement, which I do all summer long, just to keep the humidity low, it's good for you. It's good for the long-term health and durability of the house, and it almost always eliminates creatures like these big crickets and the millipedes that can suddenly show up in such huge numbers in the summertime. Did you ever get those, the little segmented guys that can show up in huge numbers?
We had one, and he was a beast. He was huge.
Oh, you might have had a true centipede, because millipedes are small.
Gigantic.
Yeah, millipedes are small. They curl up in not so much a ball, but they curl up in a circle when they're threatened, and if you crush them, they stink. Centipedes are very interesting. Centipedes are very beneficial predators. They are even better than spiders, I believe, in controlling house pests. But they are huge, and they look like somebody's toupee is running across the floor.
That is a good point. That is exactly what it looked like.
So the long-term solution for the crickets, which you see mostly in the summertime, right?
Well, that's when we first started seeing them, but they're becoming a year-round kind of a situation for us where, you know, once a month or so, a few make their way up the stairs from the basement.
Well, I think you definitely need to get a control of the humidity in the basement, because it seems like you need to be running a dehumidifier. But the short-term solution are glue traps, glue boards. You can buy them at any hardware store. They're non-toxic. You put them down, and when the crickets get caught on them, they get stuck and they can't get away. Now, the crickets are harmless. They're not going to do any harm to you, to fabrics, to your house, or anything like that. And again, if you dehumidify the air, they will simply go away because they won't like it.
Well, I thank you for all the information, Mike. You gave a name to one of the creatures in my house. You gave me some really good information as to how to get rid of them. And I think it'll help calm my husband's nerves the next time he's having to battle one with a fly swatter.
Yeah. Tell them they're absolutely harmless. You can spray them with insecticidal soap or catch them on glue traps. But again, dry out the air and they'll just go away.
Excellent. Thanks again, Mike. I enjoy your show.
My pleasure. Good luck. 1-888-346-9499. Joan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Joan, where are you?
Kalkaska, Michigan.
Oh, I've never heard that.
If you know Traverse City, we're east of Traverse City a little bit.
We know Traverse City very well. What can we do for Joan just outside of Traverse City?
We planted a maple tree 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We live on a hill, and down at the bottom there's all these maple trees. So my husband dug it up. We planted it 2 years ago, and it was fine last year and lost its leaves. But this year, most all the leaves stayed on it, and they're still on. We're just wondering why that would be.
Now, do you have any idea what kind of a maple it is?
Not really.
Because you transplanted kind of a natural sapling.
Right.
In the spring, this past spring, did it leaf out nicely?
Yes.
Did the leaves turn color in the fall?
They did, but now they're just brown and dry.
Well, you know, nobody's perfect, Joan.
No.
I mean, none of us are looking our best this time of year.
Well, the weird thing is our daughter used to live on this 10 acres, and she planted one of these trees from down the same area, and it's huge and big and beautiful, so we're trying to do the same with this. But
right, and you said it's only 2 years old, right?
Right, since
right.
We transplanted, yes.
Right, so that's just a baby. Now, you said the majority, the parent trees, are down lower on your property?
Right, they're down below a hill, and they lost all their leaves.
Okay, so that's interesting. How much lower are those trees, or how much higher up? Is it like a 10-foot difference, 20-foot?
Let me ask my husband. He's back here. Jerry, what would be down to the bottom of the hill? Was that 10-foot or 20-foot?
Maybe 30-foot.
He thinks maybe 30-foot. We live
That's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm thinking. One of the things that you have to consider when you're landscaping is that frost settles down low. So that, for instance, if you're planting a tree that flowers very early in the spring and sometimes is susceptible to a late frost, you want to plant that tree at a higher elevation on your property, because 10 foot higher or lower might make the difference between the flowers being a little stressed or the flowers being destroyed, and say a peach tree or an apple tree not producing anything that year. So the higher up, the higher of the elevation a plant is, the less cold it experiences. Now, you know, just from looking around you and from listening to the show, that this has been the most climactically wacky season
right. That
anybody can remember.
Okay.
Typically what happens with a deciduous tree is the lessening hours of daylight, the cooler nights, the change of the angle of the sun, all of these things will trigger dormancy.
Oh.
And when dormancy begins to occur, the first thing that happens is a lot of the sap, a lot of the energy drops down out of the canopy of the tree and begins its journey down to the roots, where that energy is essentially going to hide for the winter. And that's why the leaves turn color. The leaves that we see in the fall, when they, quote, turn color,
mm-hmm.
Well, that's their real color. The color was kind of knocked out by the excessive amount of chlorophyll in the tree, which is green.
Yeah.
When the chlorophyll drains out as the tree is going dormant, that's when this tree finally reveals what color the leaves are and makes fall so spectacular. One of the next things that's supposed to happen is there's a kind of a joint where the leaf is attached to a branch. When a certain chemical reaction takes place inside the tree as it's going dormant, it detaches this little leaf section and the leaves fall down. And this is all to prepare the tree for winter. Those leaves are done. They're not going to absorb solar energy anymore. They're just taking up space. Were they to stay on the tree and stay green, they would endanger the tree over winter. So a lot of people had their leaves fall super early. A lot of people are in your situation where the leaves are still on the tree. I think the difference is the difference in elevation kept your tree from experiencing the shock that the lower trees got one night, especially where that cold air all descended low, and they got the trigger they needed to drop its leaves, and your tree did not get that trigger. But it's perfectly fine. What's going to happen is when the new growth starts in the spring, all those old leaves are going to be shed, and they'll be replaced by new ones, and I don't think there's any danger or any problem.
Okay.
So I think it's just the weirdness of weather, and the difference on your landscape is that this tree is more highly elevated.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Joan. You take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners far and wide that the legendary and unsurpassed Philadelphia International Flower Show will bring the fabled flora of Hawaii to the City of Brotherly Love March 4th through the 11th. And then I'll deliver my annual talk at the Flower Show Lecture Series on Wednesday, March 7th at 12:30. But don't go marking your calendars just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls, how to care for your fruit trees, and right when we come back, how much of the nation is being invaded by running bamboo. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden, made possible in part by Burpee. Burpee is a gardening resource featuring vegetables, flowers, videos, and more. The 2012 catalog is now available online at burpee.com. You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY and You Bet Your Garden, the Delaware Home Show, presented by the Home Builders Association of Delaware, March 3rd and 4th at the Chase Center on the Riverfront in Wilmington. WHYY's own Mike McGrath, the featured garden guru, will lead seminars including Getting Your Landscape Off Drugs and Growing the Best Tomatoes Ever. Delaware Home Show vendors will highlight the latest trends in garden and home products and service. For tickets, DelawareHomeShow.com. The Delaware Home Show. Dig it.
The WHYY forecast, periods of light snow along with some rain today. The high 39. Tomorrow, sun, but windy and cold. Sunday's high 35. Right now it is cloudy and 35 degrees.
The Discover NewsWorks Facebook sweepstakes. This week, four tickets to the Flower Show and a Reading Terminal gift card. You must like NewsWorks.org on Facebook to enter. No purchase necessary. For a complete list of rules, go to NewsWorks.org. Smart. Local. News.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we're going to remind you of all the things you need to be doing to get a great harvest from your fruit trees this season, because the time to work on those trees is coming up shortly. We're going to have lots more of your fabulous phone calls as well. But now it's time to check in with some experts who are mapping the spread of nature's most invasive plant, the notorious running bamboo. And lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our special guests. Dr. Richard Mack is a professor in the School of Biological Sciences at Washington State University. Melissa Smith is a postdoctoral researcher in the School of Biological Sciences at Washington State University. They join us through the fine auspices of Northwest Public Radio, and they are here to talk about one of our favorite topics, running bamboo. Dr. Mack, it's my understanding that you two are among the first to actually start categorizing the spread of this running monster across the nation.
Well, I suppose that's fair to say in terms of one of the of an early group of us. I mean, there have been anecdotal records for quite some time, and that's been the problem. They've been anecdotal. So some of the research that we're doing now is to try to get a much better handle geographically on the extent of this issue. Is it really a major environmental problem that's looming? And if so, what are the particulars of it?
Your specialty in the School of Biological Science is, for lack of a better word, the study of plant invasions, right? Invasive plants and what effects they're having.
That's right. That's the bulk of my research throughout my career has been involved with biological invasions, and you're correct, primarily in plant invasions.
So everybody's familiar with kudzu, which was brought in to control erosion and now kind of has redefined the South, and the famous living fence of Malta Flora Rose. Are you saying that running bamboo was kind of not on the list up until now?
I think that's fair to say, and certainly also in the same breath say that we're talking about, of course, many different species here. So we don't want to just make a carte blanche statement about all running bamboos, although we may, in fact, our research may lead us to more or less come to that conclusion. But yes, it really hasn't gotten very much attention except very locally. I mean, literally where an individual property owner has seen a problem. And so that, of course, gets us back to the research we're trying to do now, is to get some handle on just how serious a problem is this.
And it probably doesn't surprise you to hear that a neighbor's bamboo encroaching on someone else's property is one of the most frequent phone calls we get, and one for which, I mean, there's really no satisfying answer. I mean, I tell them what they can do, but I feel bad telling them.
Well, they're really equipped with very few tools, Mike, and I'm sure you realize this. As long as that bamboo stand is there and is on the neighbor's property, there's very little that you, as the adjoining neighbor, can do to keep it off of yours, except for this yearly, annual, frequent attack to stymie the spread of these rhizomes onto your property.
And as you know, the rhizomes are just waiting for you to have knee surgery or to take a sabbatical to Italy or even fall asleep for longer, an hour longer some night. And it just invades like mad. It's like mosquitoes swarming over your property.
Exactly. Constant vigilance.
We should mention here that, you know, there is no one bamboo, although for the focus of this show, we do like to break the family down into two members, the running bamboos, the aggressive ones whose lateral spread is almost beyond belief, and then the clumping bamboos that behave more like ornamental grasses. I presume you two aren't worried about the ornamental clumping bamboos.
That's a very good distinction. I mean, that's a taxonomically valid distinction that you're making between the clumpers and the spreaders, or the runners and the clumpers. And it turns out to be a useful designation in terms of the issues that we're concerned with here, too.
Because it is rare that people call us in advance. The car has already crashed through the wall most of the time by the time they get to us. But on that rare case where somebody says they want to plant a bamboo, they love the structure. It is arguably one of the most beautiful plants in the world, even the aggressive kind. We're happy to tell them that there are enthusiasts all over America who love these clumping bamboos, and they come in every size, shape and color and type of performance, and you could fill a huge landscape with clumping bamboos and only touch the surface of this vast genetic resource.
That's correct.
What defines these aggressive bamboos?
Well, generally speaking, it's a rhizome morphology, which the technical term is called leptomorphic rhizomes, and that's that there's a long distance between the nodes of the rhizomes, so they spread far before they send up a new culm, and whereas the clumpers have very short distances between each of those nodes on the rhizome.
So they're doing the same thing underground, but some are sprinters and some are long-distance runners.
That's exactly right.
I have said, and I don't know if I've been correct, I heard this once, and of course that's all I need to do to repeat something as a fact, that when you see a grove of running bamboo, that you're not looking at a grove of maybe 500 plants. You're looking at one plant that has 500 culms coming up out of it.
That's right, yes. And very likely you're looking really at one plant, one genetic individual.
And that's it's the Borg. It just replicates itself and replicates itself.
Yes. Yes, it does. It's a very simple geometry, a very simple formula by which the plant produces more of itself in terms of new stems.
Now, what happened to take this plant from the backyard argument? What put it on your radar? Because this, to me, means that now we're talking about something where neighbors are mad at each other, to something that might be crowding out native plants or ruining the ecology of a fragile area.
Well, our work began with our concerns about what's going on in the Pacific Northwest, where we are. So, frankly, I was ignorant of the scale of the problem in the East when we began this work. But it had to do with very much the same situation, people talking about how it was spreading, ads appearing in little local newspapers on the Olympic Peninsula by excavators offering to take out escaped bamboos. That was a signal to me that something was amiss, that something was going on that we hadn't become aware of before. And so the more we looked into it, the more we found reason that we should really explore this and sort out just exactly what was going on.
So we're speaking with Dr. Richard Mack and postdoctoral researcher Melissa Smith from the Washington State University School of Biological Sciences. And your goal is to quantify just what percentage of the country is covered by bamboo, for lack of a better word, right now.
Yeah, the broader goal of the project is to look at that. Now, my tenure may not actually meet that goal, but certainly that's the goal of this broader databasing project.
For the last 5 years, we've been characterizing the habitats in which bamboos can persist in the Pacific Northwest, and certainly the results have implications for the East as well. We're particularly concerned about forest habitats, which would be much more difficult to extract these bamboos from if they were to escape into them. And so we've been quantifying, using various physiological parameters, just how well will they tolerate our coniferous forests. Because for many of these species, they're similar to the kind of habitats they have in their native ranges in Asia.
I think you got it backwards, unfortunately, Dr. Mack. Because I inherited a grove of bamboo that I estimate to be about 70 years old now, on the other side of a stream, thank goodness, from my house. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty well controlled by a county road that's paved and a stream. But it has taken part of what was once an old growth forest, and the trees are dead. I can't say that I saw the bamboo take the trees down and strangle them, but all of the trees in the grove are dead, and the grove seems to be very happy with that.
No, and that's what they look like in Asia. So they have this strategy of if a tree falls down or if it dies of other natural causes, the bamboo will happily come in and take over the entire area, in which case it will persist for 70, 80, 90, 160 years until it flowers, fruits, and then dies, in which case that starts potentially the forest succession again in these Asian countries. But we don't really know what will happen to these large stands in North America.
Have you two been surprised by your preliminary research, finding out how much of the country has been invaded by this stuff and how quickly it spreads?
Well, absolutely. And I think the previous 5 years of research that I've done have pointed to that the fact that these plants are incredibly hardy. They're frost tolerant, they're shade tolerant, they can handle drought. And so, you know, after knowing all of this, we probably should have known that they can propagate all over North America, but the extent to which this is a problem, I think, was surprising.
You know, what we have tried to get the word out for over a decade, and you still hear of people, oh, a friend of mine gave me some beautiful bamboo to plant. Boy, it's growing great.
Yes, unfortunately, that's how the beginning of many people's nightmares starts, that they get a beautiful clump of bamboo, they plant it without any kind of barrier, and then they wake up or come back from vacation and it has taken over their yard and the neighbors, and now there's a city council after them.
All right. We've been speaking with Dr. Richard Mack, a professor in the School of Biological Sciences at Washington State University, and Melissa Smith, a postdoctoral researcher at the School of Biological Sciences at Washington State University. They joined us through the kind auspices of Northwest Public Radio. Dr. Mack, Melissa, thanks very much for being on You Bet Your Garden.
Our pleasure.
Thank you, Mike. Having us.
And now, back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Amanda, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being had, Amanda. Where are you?
Well, I'm in Henderson, Texas, but I'm actually calling, I guess, for Nacogdoches, Texas.
What can we do for Amanda in Texas?
I am calling. My husband is a student at Stephen F. Austin University. He's an environmental science student. And one of his teachers has given them a challenge to grow bush beans in a pot, mm-hmm. and to see who can get the biggest biomass by the end of the semester. And we just wanted to do it organic and win.
Right. Now, when you say biomass, they're not going to count the weight of any beans. They're just going to pull the plants out of the ground and weigh them all.
Yeah, he's going to chop them off at the base of the dirt and weigh them. So if we get beans, that's good. If we don't, then as long as it weighs the most.
Right, and you don't care if you do something to inhibit the bean formula, as long as you get the weight of the plant in this case.
That's correct.
The first thing you need to know is that peas and beans are both unique plants in our garden. They are both what are called nitrogen-fixing legumes. That means that when they have a naturally occurring bacteria come in contact with their roots, a naturally occurring soil bacteria, it will develop nodules on the roots, living organisms of a symbiotic sort. And these organisms will give the bean plant the ability to take nitrogen from the air we breathe and convert it into their own plant food. And most farmers and gardeners buy the bacteria in powder form. It's completely organic. As they're planting their seed, they'll take some of this bacteria, which looks like a fine black powder, and they'll put the pea or bean seeds into a plastic bag, moisten it a little bit, pour in some of this bacteria, and literally roll the seeds around in it until they're covered in it. And then they'll put it in wherever they're going to put it. In your case, you want to keep it nice and warm, right around 70 degrees, so the plants get off to a fast start, because every day is going to count in this competition. As soon as they achieve a certain size, they'll have the ability to take extra food out of the air. And if you're competing against other people who have not inoculated their seeds, that's the technical term for this, you'll win almost by definition. And these are in a container, so I recommend you use my container formula, which is 3/4 of a soil-free mix and 1/4 compost. Get the seeds germinated fast. That probably means saturating the soil, putting a plastic wrap over top, and inspecting the pot twice a day, keeping it not hot. You don't want it to be over 75 degrees. You want it to stay between 65 and 70 in the soil. As soon as the first sprouts are up, take the plastic off, start exposing it to the brightest light you can. If you don't have the right kind of sunlight, hang a shop light over it with 2 40-watt, 4-foot-long fluorescent tubes, and keep the tubes almost touching the tops of the plants. And then you want to wait until the plants have what are called their first true leaves. The first leaves on most plants are these little kind of rounded, weird guys. But then after that, the plant starts putting out what are called its true leaves, which are the leaves that look like the majority of the leaves on the plant. As soon as you have 4 good true leaves on each plant, you can start feeding it an organic fertilizer. In this case, I would highly recommend a fish and seaweed mix, although I have to warn you, The fish component would be a little smelly indoors, but it's a great natural source of nitrogen. And when you want to grow a big plant fast, you want nitrogen. Your alternative would be composted poultry manure or composted horse manure. In the long run, in the garden outdoors, this might inhibit the number of beans because your plant would be getting too much nitrogen and not enough of the nutrients that produce the quote-unquote fruits. But you're just growing for a big plant, so you don't want a balanced fertilizer.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for all your help, and it's great talking to you.
Well, thank you for having an organic competition. I can tell you many organic growers have won big tomato contests. It is not a limitation at all, and I wish your husband great success.
Thank you. I will let you know how it goes.
Yeah, please do. Please do.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and check up on my little baby lettuce and spinach starts. It's still way too cold to germinate seeds outside here in the Northeast, but it will soon be safe for month-old plants to go outside, at least if those plants are cold-weather-loving salad greens, which don't mind a chill one bit. But don't you go getting a jump on the season with a romaine Russian spinach shuffle just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to care for your fruit trees this spring. I'm Fruity Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible in part by Burpee. For over 135 years, Burpee has provided gardeners with seeds and plants for everything from tomatoes to flowers to gourmet herbs. Online at burpee.com.
It's 11:38, 35 degrees in Center City.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. The Delaware Master Gardeners will help you properly prepare your landscape for spring on Tuesday, February 21st at 7 p.m. at the University of Delaware in Newark. The Longwood Graduate Program will bring zoos and public gardens together for their annual symposium on Friday, March 2nd at Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square, PA. I'll appear at the Delaware Home Show at the Chase Center in Wilmington on Saturday, March 3rd. The Philadelphia Flower Show opens on Sunday, March 4th and runs through Sunday the 11th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center at 12th and Arch Streets. I'll deliver my annual lecture at the Flower Show and premiere my new book on tomato growing Wednesday, March 7th at 12:30. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
We invite you to join us for Fresh Air Weekend today. Meryl Streep is our guest. Her performance as Margaret Thatcher in The Iron Lady has earned Streep her 17th Oscar nomination, an award she's won twice for her roles in Kramer vs. Kramer and Sophie's Choice. Also, New York Times science reporter William Broad talks about yoga, its risks and rewards. Join us for Fresh Air Weekend at 1 today on WHYY. The forecast, periods of light snow and rain throughout the day, the high about 39.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll talk about the proper care of fruit trees, just in time, because the time to do the pruning and get ready for the thinning of the fruits that is so essential is right around the corner. So we're going to talk to an expert and make sure we're doing it right. But before that, couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Curry, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing well, Curry. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, too.
And where are you doing well?
Well, I'm doing well in southeast D.C. My window looks out at the Navy Yard escalator at the Metro.
Okay, Curry, near our nation's capital with a view of a metro station.
Well, no, actually, we live in Loudoun County, and I commute to D.C. every day.
Right, well, the D.C. area, I should have said. And you've got a station right outside. You got it made.
Yeah, there's a lot to look at, that's for sure.
So what can we do for Curry in Loudoun County?
Well, last spring, we have two cherry trees that were very, very healthy, and they produced a great deal of blossoms, and pretty soon they were just covered, smothered with little cherries forming all over them.
Right.
And as I mowed the grass around them, I had visions of seeing, you know, cherry pie, cherry cobbler, cherry sauce on crepes, all kinds of delicious things. And then as the spring progressed, the little cherry buds turned yellow and dropped off.
I had visions of that happening when you talked about mowing the grass around them. Are they actually growing out of a lawn?
Yes.
And is the lawn treated?
No.
No herbicides? No weed?
No herbicides. We have chickens roaming, so we don't want them to be poisoned.
You have chickens roaming. Well, congratulations. I apologize for thinking you had a chemically intensive lawn. You've got chickens. We must solve your cherry problem. So what is at the base of your plants, then, the cherry trees?
Well, just what we planted them with. They were mulched and planted, and we really haven't done anything more than that. We don't feed them. We do water them when it's dry out, and it was dry last spring.
Right.
And other than that, nothing.
And how old are these trees? Have they produced crops before?
Last year they had a few cherries, but the birds got them mostly.
We were going to talk about that in a minute, yeah.
Yeah, no, this year was the first year they were really profuse with their budding and the little cherries just covering them.
And you installed these plants yourself 4 years ago, and they are pie cherries. They are tart cherries.
Yes, uh-huh.
And you got two of them.
Yes.
The key here is that they flower really nicely.
Yes.
That's the sign of healthy plants to begin with. Now, you say they're mulched. What are they mulched with, and how thick is it? And it's not piled up against the trunks, is it?
No, it's not.
I think that, first of all, we did have a wretched summer. It got way too hot, way too early, and it was very dry. I'm glad to hear that you did do some watering, but then it rained and rained and rained. So it was a poor year for crops. Now, what I would like you to do, I would like you to get rid of this old mulch that you have underneath the trees and replace it with an inch of compost. I presume the mulch is there to help keep the lawn at bay and to help you mow the lawn without you banging into the trees?
Well, and to help keep moisture in the ground for the roots.
If you are mulching to keep moisture in the ground, you start about a foot away from the bark. And, boy, cherry trees grow fast, and they grow pretty large. So I would imagine that to do what you're doing, the mulch would have to go out a good 10, 12 feet.
Oh, I sure didn't do that.
Right. But that's where the roots are that are absorbing the moisture. They are on the outskirts. If you look up at the canopy of the tree when it's fully leafed out, that mimics the root system. It's a mirror image underground. Incorrectly applied mulch, wood mulch, will stunt the growth of plants like this, will interfere with fruiting. So, again, I want you to take away that combination of wood chips and dirt and put it somewhere. It sounds like you have a big property. Let it compost down. For your fruit trees, I think if we get rid of whatever mulch you have there, and then starting about a foot away from the tree, I want you to get a real high-quality yard waste compost, mostly fall leaves, you know, but it's all turned into rich black compost. And starting a foot away from the tree, go out as far as you can with the compost, as much compost as you have. Every time it rains, you'll get a little compost tea feeding the root system of the trees. I think this year, though, you're going to have to get serious about the birds. I don't think you're going to have your failure again. And once those cherries start to mature, birds are going to fight you for every one. So you're going to have to figure out a way to rig up some netting or get some bird scare flash tape or aim a couple of motion-activated sprinklers up there. But birds are the arch enemy of people who want to harvest their own cherries.
Okay, I'll try that.
All right, good luck, sir.
Appreciate your suggestions. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Dave, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello,
Dave. How are
you
today?
I'm doing just fine, sir. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
And where is Dave Well?
Calling from Louisville, Kentucky.
All right. Very good. What can we do for you, sir?
Yeah, I had a question about my vegetable garden. I've got a raised bed, 8 feet by 16 feet, and it's full of compost and good things and should be doing really well. But I've got these huge tulip poplar trees that block it for the morning sun. It
gotcha.
Gets afternoon sun, but nothing before 2 in the afternoon. So last year, I had lots and lots of vines, and they grew 8 feet tall, but very little fruit.
Now,
but I can't cut down the trees. I can't really move the garden to another location because I don't have much space left.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if there's anything I can do to get these plants to perform better.
Well, first of all, you don't have a raised bed garden. I hate to break it to you.
Okay.
Because you're walking in there. So I want to reiterate for everybody that raised beds should never be wider than 4 feet so that you're not stepping on the soil inside the bed so that you can work the soil from either side. Is there a way that you can divvy up this bed or rebuild it that you can make 2, 3, or 4 foot wide, 16 foot long raised beds?
Yes.
Because that would be much better for your plants. If I heard you correctly, that your plants are only getting late day sun?
From 2 o'clock on. They get
yeah.
the afternoon.
That's not going to make a tomato plant happy. You said you got lush plants, but not a lot of fruit.
That's right.
Did you have any signs of disease on the plants?
No.
Okay. So I'm guessing your climate, at least last summer or the last couple of summers, is very dry in the summertime.
It was very dry last summer and really hot.
Okay, well, that's good. You and I are compadres. I mean, I made the mistake of buying Snow White's old house in the woods, which is great if you want the chipmunks to come in and help with the dishes, but not really good if you want to grow tomatoes and peppers because I have the same sun-challenged problems. So what are you feeding your plants?
General Osmocote.
Oh, okay. You got to stop. Again,
okay.
That's a chemical fertilizer.
Right, I know.
Your plants, because they don't get sun till late in the day, they are going to naturally utilize less food. People sometimes think, whoa, I got plants in the shade. I need to overfeed them so to kind of help compensate for the sun. But it doesn't. It just stresses the plants because they're not using nutrients at a rate that normal plants can. And your chemical fertilizer might actually be inhibiting the flowering on your tomatoes. So I want you to switch to compost. I want you to find a naturally high fertilizer for fruiting crops like tomatoes. And this will be a mixture that has some nitrogen in it, but not a lot. A good amount of phosphorus, which promotes the development of flowers and later fruits, and some potassium, which is good for the overall health of the plant. But again, feed them lightly. The fact that your climate is very dry and hot is going to be a big help. Do they get really bright sun late in the day?
Yes.
Okay. Two things you can do. One is, especially while we're still in the winter, are there any branches that could be pruned back now that are lower to the ground, even if they don't get more sun directly on the plants to increase the airflow in there and the air circulation?
It's a fairly clear area around the garden, but there's I've got some very large hemlocks and Norway spruce.
This is a great situation for pruning of some lower limbs if it's not going to be a problem in your landscape. If you're using the lower limbs for screening, then forget it. But if you can, increasing the airflow, and sometimes you'll prune off a branch that doesn't seem to be stopping the sun, and you'll get more sun in there. Otherwise, there's only one other trick. Now, I think building raised beds, true raised beds, keeping your feet off there, switching to a natural fertilizer, I think you're going to see some tomatoes. What really shade-cursed people do, they will build a white reflective wall at one edge of their garden to concentrate the sunlight or maybe get it on there a little bit more. Not really a reflective material like aluminum foil or anything like that, but just like white foam core to bring more sun in at the times when you get some. If you search this online, you'll see diagrams of people who've done it. People will surround their gardens or the side that can reflect sun back on the plant with a white reflective material. And there are some people who rave about it, who say it saved them.
I will give that a try.
Oh, all right. Well, we wish you the best of tomato growing luck this season.
Thanks very much, Mike.
All right. Take care, man.
Bye-bye.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. How and when to prune and care for fruit trees? Our question comes from John, just south of Fredericksburg, Virginia, who writes, I'm confused about my fruit trees. The past 2 years, I've pruned my apple, peach, pear, and plum trees right after the dead of winter. But we only seem to have had 1 or 2 days of, quote, dead winter this season, and I'm concerned that the trees might not go fully dormant. Is that concern warranted? And when exactly should we be pruning? I'm concerned about getting the timing right, or at least not horribly wrong. Well, I've been thinking about the same thing, John. Not about dormancy, but about timing. I think I've been doing the right things at the right time of year to keep my wife's peach trees as healthy and productive as possible, but I just never feel certain. And I suspect that many fruit tree growers out there share the same agita. And this is the time of year to sort these kind of issues out. So I called one of our most frequent guests and sources, Dr. Lee Reich, author of Landscaping with Fruits, as well as the pruning book and a new tome titled Growing Fruit Naturally that's due out in March from the Taunton Press. First, Lee says not to worry about dormancy. The key triggers for plants to go dormant for the winter are things like lessening hours of daylight and cooler nights. They don't need to be below freezing for weeks at a time to get a good winter's rest. And your timing on the pruning seems close to perfect. Lee says the ideal time to prune fruit trees is, quote, after the coldest part of winter is over but before bloom begins, which is typically early to mid-February. And if you're going to err, Lee feels it's safer to prune a little bit later rather than earlier, especially with peaches, it turns out. When my trees were in their second year, I called Lee to say that I was completely taken by the beauty of the flowers, which I felt put apple blossoms to shame, he agreed. And I asked him if I might be damaging the trees, however, by waiting to prune them until after the big show was over, because I wanted to enjoy every peach blossom. He said back then that he saw no problem with letting the trees flower before pruning. And in our recent talk, he actually moved it up into the good idea category. Peach trees can often suffer a little winter injury, he notes, and letting them flower clearly shows you which branches have been winter killed. Plus, he adds, pruning wounds heal fastest when the tree is just beginning to grow for the season, and that fast healing helps limit problems from pathogens trying to take hold in the cut areas. Is that just for peaches, I asked? Nope. Any tree can be pruned while it's still in flower, and you'll get those same benefits, he replied. But he quickly added that peaches do require the heaviest pruning of any fruit crop. You need to make thinning cuts and heading cuts to keep the center of the tree open and to stimulate new growth for the following year. And in general, he adds, you need to cut more than you probably think you should. I agreed and explained that while I thought I was pruning pretty aggressively every season, some of my trees were clearly still way too lush and full when they leafed out. You need to prune by the cat-tossing method, he replied. Huh? You need to prune so that when you're done, you could take a cat and easily toss it through the openings between the remaining branches, he explained. I asked Lee if he had a tree cat he used for this purpose. No comment, he answered quickly, then added, if the image disturbs you, imagine pruning so that a large bird can fly through the remaining branches easily. I told him I kind of liked the image of the flying cat. People tend to remember the advice more with that one, he noted. Apple trees don't need to be pruned as aggressively, he continued, but they still need lots of thinning when the fruits begin forming. Ah, yes, the thinning of the fruits. I told Lee how guilty I feel when I'm out there filling 5-gallon buckets with little baby peaches, not to mention how time-consuming the process is. But it's absolutely essential, he stressed. Peaches and apples need to have the vast majority of their developing fruits removed if you want to harvest good quality fruits at the end of the season. And the sooner you remove them, the better the results you'll get. get all of the extra fruits off the tree while they're still tiny, and the tree can then devote the maximum amount of energy to the ones that are left behind. Is this another area, like peach tree pruning, where people typically don't go far enough, I asked? Absolutely, replied Lee, who would probably have been waving a finger disapprovingly at me if we weren't talking on the phone. And maybe he was anyway. It's been estimated that to get the ideal harvest of big, well-shaped fruits, only one apple blossom in 20 should be allowed to set fruit, he told me. Only one in 20? 5%, he assured me. Looks like I'm going to need a bigger bucket. Well, that sure was some helpful information about correctly caring for your fruit trees, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To carefully review this week's edition, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to toss a cat into my branches if I don't get out of this studio. Meow. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Put the actual subject in the subject line and check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section and or listen to this show, listen to old shows and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer is Kevin Love Train Griffin. Our webmasters are Baneful Rich Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. The well-pruned Alexis Landis produces and co-edits You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Sweet as a peach is our production assistant, Amanda No Relation McGrath. Our editor is Al Don't Toss That Cat Banks. I'm the one-man pruning band, Mike McGrath, and I'll make sure to drop the loppers so I can see you next week. Nothing livens up a summer day like a hummingbird sighting. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, I'll reveal what you can do to lure these little winged wonders to your landscape, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Spinach, sunflowers, safflowers, spider plants, spring, and snow. Mike's got advice on how to handle it all for a sumptuous garden. Tune in Saturday mornings at 11 for You Bet Your Garden here on WHYY.